Two in the Middle. I'm Joey Block. Republicans have officially clinched the House majority, securing control of both chambers of Congress as well as the presidency. So it's the ultimate trifecta that Republicans were hoping to get for. Well, they officially have notched control of the federal government. The GOP captured the majority when Arizona Congressman Juan Ciscomani won his re-election bid narrowly against Democrat Kirsten Engel, bringing Republicans to the grand total of 218 that is needed. Now, obviously, they could expand that total depending on what news outlet you're watching or depending on what time of day or what day it is that you're even listening to this. That number could change. But what we do know 100% everybody seems to be in agreement on is that the Republicans will retain control of the House. That is the headline there. A key part of the reason of why Republicans were able to keep their control of the lower chamber was because of a number of races that ultimately broke their way. That's including Gabe Evans flipping Colorado's 8th District red, the GOP garnering 2 seats out of the Keystone State, aka Pennsylvania. Then they also were able to capture 3 races in North Carolina and turn those seats red. Then they managed to squeak out a seat in Michigan, flipping a congressional seat there red, as well as holding on to a number of matchups in California to ultimately be able to come out on top and be able to pull this out. Now, it's important to know here, Republicans did not come completely unscathed. They also lost seats in some states, including 3 in New York, Mark Molinaro. He lost Anthony D'Esposito and also Brandon Williams up in New York State, that area around the Buffalo, Syracuse area. Yeah, that was not pretty for him. They also lost in the suburbs of Portland. That was one, Portland, Oregon, where they picked up that seat 2 years ago. They have lost that seat. They lost another one in California. Mike Garcia, who originally won it in a special election back in 2020, that seat went down. And they also came up short in a highly, hotly contested race in Virginia for the now departing Abigail Spanberger's seat. She is now running for governor in that state in 2025, and she left her seat to go do that. She's retiring this year. So Republicans were hoping to pick up something there. That did not happen. So that leads to the larger question here of what the GOP strategy should be going forward. Now, it is important to note there are still races that have not been called yet in California and Alaska where they are still counting ballots. So this is possible for the GOP to expand on this margin. They could win that lone seat out of Alaska where Mary Pattola is the Democrat there. She won because Sarah Palin and the other guy who is running now also narrowly lost that seat because of Frank Choi's voting, where basically her and him, they went up against one another. And as a result, they canceled each other out because they didn't want to go through the ranked choice voting thing, because it's basically, there's no primary system. It's an all-in primary. Everybody just kind of runs jungle primary, you could call it. And one Democrat ran, and that's how Pattola pulled that off. So it still leads a question here for the Republicans of how they want to run this majority going forward. Because now, remember the big key, what everyone was talking about this election, what's going to happen in New York? That could determine what the majority is. Now, they lucked out because the Republicans are able to pick up in other areas of the country to make up for that. So now their entire House majority does not rely on New York. Because remember, they had the big pickup. They had the 4-seat pickup. Obviously, with George Santos going down, Tom Suozzi came back in, took that seat. So they knew that one was kind of gone for good, or at least for now. So they weren't expecting that one. But then when Mark Molinaro went down and Anthony DiPasito went down and Brandon Williams went down. That is a larger sign of trouble. And if you were relying solely on those guys to hold on to your majority, you would kind of be screwed. You would not be having the majority right now. Now, it has shifted westward. Now, it's in California where there are a number of seats that Republicans are relying on to stay red. So, now, that begs the question, how much effort do you want to put into them? Because if you lose California, then you might potentially lose the House majority. Now, could be wrong. They could end up picking seats up in 2 years in different parts of the country like they did now, and California may not be as big of a factor. And if they end up losing a seat or two there, it may not be the end of the world. But as of right now, that is what's going to determine their margin, is how these races play out in California. So they're either going to have to put all their chips on that basket or protecting California, or they're going to have to go out and do something else. Now, a lot of Republicans out there celebrating, they're not thinking about that. But the reality is, that could be a weak spot for them, because Democrats got a lot of money in California, so they know how to use it. So they can easily go into those swing districts and mess around with them. Especially as we know, the results are still pending here. How many of them are Harris districts? How many of them are Biden districts? Probably more Biden districts, because as we all know, Harris underperformed Biden all across the country. So it's really more the Biden districts at this point. Because, yes, there were people like Tom Kaine who won in Biden districts for re-election, despite concerns that they weren't going to. And in fact, some of those districts went for Trump this time around, which is the case with the 7th Congressional District here in New Jersey, where Trump was able to carry the district. So it is possible that that might not be a factor in this after all, but if it is, then the Republicans have to invest a little more in expanding the coalition and really building up that infrastructure. If you're the Republicans, you want to obviously defend California. California, California, California. You may want to go on offense. You might want to go get those New York seats back, because that might be the key to the castle. Meaning, if you want to expand the majority, you might have to go back and pick up some seats you once had. Also, you might want to go to some places you haven't thought about before that are closer than expected. Just look at New Jersey's 9th Congressional District. How many of you out there actually thought that was going to be that close? Now, on this show, if you listen, you kind of were following it, because we spoke about this last election cycle, how it came within 10 or 11 points, and that was quite shocking, considering this is a district that Bill Pascrell, who is now departed from the planet, won by 30 or 40 points in the past, and now 10 to 11 points. Now, only won by single digits. That could be a sign for something. Is it just a trend that isn't going to really mean anything? Or is this a district that if Republicans put some serious cash in, they might be able to do something here? If that's the case, then they might be able to go into districts like that where things were closer than expected, and they might be able to go into it, especially given the new coalitions that they're forming with Hispanics, with more black voters, that maybe they can put something together that appeals to these people and find the right candidate and possibly flip these districts. Now, if you're the Democrats, you clearly want to go into California over the next 2 years and really invest in the state. Although it is blue, obviously room for improvement. And you could even go in there and flip some of these seats. Mike Garcia, fine example. That is a guy who Republicans have touted as a great success story. He's someone that people were proud of, that he was able to flip that seat in that special election, and now he's gone, at least for now. There are seats that the Democrats could go in and do something with. How about Tom Kaine even in New Jersey? Could Tom Malinowski make a comeback and possibly beat him, because there is evidence to suggest that the district is becoming bluer. It's in fact probably the only part of New Jersey that might be coming bluer because of Hunterdon County, and that is shifting more to the left these days. So could Democrats put money into those places? And of course, the Biden districts is where they would probably want to put money into, because for the most part, the Republicans went into the strategy of, all right, we got to flip these Trump districts, which are districts where, and there are very few, and there's probably more Republicans representing, you know, Biden districts than there are Democrats representing Trump districts. But the point being is, the theory is, okay, former President Trump, now President-elect Trump, he's won these districts in the past consistently, but these Democrats keep winning. How do we do this? How do we flip these districts, flip these seats red? And for the most part, they were able to succeed. But yeah, for Democrats, you want to go into those places and pick up seats, because if you go into those areas, again, with a margin like this, we know it's going to be tight. We may not know the full margin, but we know it's going to be in the single digits. All you got to do is keep picking one from here, picking one from there, go across the country, do a little bit of that, do a little bit of that, and you can get yourself a majority. Now, obviously, you want the biggest majority possible, but that might not necessarily be the case. So this is going to be a dynamic we're watching for sure in the House, because the Senate, that's a different story. On the Senate side, Republicans have picked John Thune to be the next majority leader. The South Dakota senator beat out Texas's John Cornyn and Florida's Rick Scott in two rounds of secret ballots. In the first round, Thune received 25 votes to Cornyn's 15 and to Scott's 13. Then Scott was eliminated and senators went back to the drawing board, where Thune got 29 votes and Cornyn received 24 on that second round of voting. And he needed 27, Thune, to win, and he was able to clinch that number more or less. He got two extras, so it's always good to have that pad. And that was an interesting result that shocked some people in the conservative movement, because going into this, Scott received a lot of outside support from high-profile people like Elon Musk and conservative talk show host Sean Hannity. So given that, people thought, oh, there's this movement, there's momentum building here, what's going to happen? Well, it came up short. Scott did not get that. In fact, didn't even make it past the first round. It was Cornyn who made it to the next round, not Rick Scott. That's for sure. But a little more digging into Thune, he's essentially been the outgoing leader, Mitch McConnell's right-hand man since 2019, when he became Senate Republican whip. And to give you context, that is the second highest ranking position in the United States Senate. That is it in your party. If you're looking to get the top job in the Senate, you want to be in that position. And although Cornyn was in that position for a while before Thune had it, Thune was there through all of it. Especially, he was kind of running things behind the scenes when McConnell had that health scare earlier this year. So he has the relationships with these senators and is able to build a coalition. Because as you know, you saw what went on in the House the past couple of years. Building coalitions, having trust from your members, and to be able to unify a conference is very important if you're trying to move an agenda item going forward. If you're trying to move something forward and you don't have everybody on board, it's not happening. In the House, tight, tight margins. In the Senate, it is tight margins, because if you count McCormick in there, which, you know, depending on the news outlet that you're watching and you're listening to, they might not say he's won. It's, you know, putting that aside, of course, let's say he's in it, 53. 53 is your best case scenario. That means you can only lose three people And that it would be if Vice President-elect Vance cast the tie-breaking vote. But then you also have to remember, you got Marco Rubio, who's been tapped for the Secretary of State position, which we're going to talk about all that in a moment, too. And you have Vance himself, who's going to be the Vice President. So there's already two seats you're not going to have. So the margins are even tighter than that until Florida Governor Ron DeSantis and Ohio Governor Mike DeWine get in there and make their picks known for who they want to fill those seats until they can have special elections, which I believe in Ohio, it's not for another 2 years. And Florida, I believe they're working on a schedule right now to when they can do that, because obviously they have some vacancies they have to fill on the House side too. So Republicans seem to think Thune is the guy. And for Scott, Scott is a more interesting case here because, yes, a lot of conservatives are into him, but as you recall, there are some warning signs with Scott. For one, he put out a big plan of how Republicans can improve America, and one of the bullet points was tax increases. And he got a lot of blowback for that, including from Mitch McConnell. This was back when he was trying to oust McConnell from the Senate Majority Leader position. And conservatives really hammered him for this. And it's quite ironic now they go from hammering him about that to now being like, oh, we love the guy. We want him to be the Senate Majority Leader. But he got a lot of blowback. And I think a lot of these Senate Republicans were like, oh, we don't want to go through this again. We're done with this. We need a guy who has the principles of the party. Because remember, Republicans, they're all about tax cuts. You can't go around having a plan that increases taxes. You want to know the last Republican on the national stage who increased taxes? Give it a second. Who do you think that guy was? He went by the name George H.W. Bush. What happened to the guy? Oh, right. He was a one-term president. Didn't work out for him very well. Then, also with Scott, he was a key architect behind the Republicans' 2022 election strategy. What happened there? Well, you might recall, they did not get the Senate that year. The House went to the GOP, but the Republicans did not gain control of the Senate. So, with that in mind, picking a guy to then lead the conference, and also cases where you do have to be involved in candidate selection and to decide where to put super PAC money in terms of defending incumbents or trying to pick up new seats, that might be a concern for you. If this guy, because the criticism from a lot of people out there was that Scott basically just put his feet up and let Trump pick all the people, and then the people that were selected in the primary process couldn't win the general election. While Steve Daines, who took over this time, said, okay, this is what we're going to do. We're going to find individual candidates we like. We're going to get them to the primary, and they will then be better suited for the general election. As a result, that ended up working in a case of Montana. Tim Sheehy was handpicked. Then you had West Virginia, Jim Justice. He won there. Bernie Marino kind of, I mean, Trump obviously liked all these people too, so it worked out. But Bernie Marino was probably a little more of a Trump guy, to be honest, but they still got him through. Looking at Trump in general, though, as I mentioned here, the Senate now are going to have a few less people because they're going to have to fill some seats because President-elect Trump has made a number of announcements when it comes to who will be in the next administration. The latest additions to the list include former Georgia Congressman Doug Collins, that is for Veterans Affairs Secretary, and Florida Congressman Matt Gaetz for Attorney General. That has caused quite a stir within Washington. Also, some announcements were made as of the last couple of days. North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum, he is going to be getting Interior Secretary. Of course, that is pending Senate confirmation for that one. And also, former presidential candidate Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is also being tapped for the top job at Health and Human Services. Other picks for the next administration, and again, some of them do not require the Senate to sign off on them. Some of them, he just appoints them and that's the end of it. But a lot of them are going to have to go through the confirmation process. Other picks for this administration include former Hawaii Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard for Director of National Intelligence, Florida Senator Marco Rubio for Secretary of State, Elon Musk and former GOP presidential candidate Vivek Ramaswamy to run the Department of Government Efficiency, South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem as DHS Secretary, Fox News host Pete Hegseth for Defense Secretary, former Intel Chief John Ratcliffe as CIA Director, former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee for Ambassador to Israel, former ICE Director Tom Homan as Border Czar, Florida Congressman Mike Waltz as National Security Advisor, New York Congresswoman Elise Stefanik for UN Ambassador, former New York Congressman Lee Zeldin as EPA Administrator, former White House Senior Advisor Stephen Miller as Deputy Chief of Staff on Policy, and also Dan Scavino is going to be the Deputy Chief of Staff altogether. So a lot of names there that some you've heard of, some you may have not heard of, depending on how much you follow politics. And again, there are hundreds of other people who are going to get roles too that, you know, we're not going to really talk about and or really hear much about at all because they're so low level or the names are unknown. But again, some of these people are going to make it through and some are not, because statistically speaking, for every administration, 1 to 2 people who are initially picked do not make it over the finish line. Biden, for example, had a pick where she just had a lot of questionable statements that she made online about race and everything of that nature, and they had to pull out. They didn't have the votes in the Senate. And remember, Biden had a Democratic Senate to get these people appointed, and they weren't able to get her through. So that was Biden. Trump, in his first term, tried to get a labor secretary through who came under fire for saying he wanted to replace people with robots. That was the allegation, that he wanted to automate jobs. And as you know, a lot of the Trump 2016 campaign, as well as this campaign, was about American workers being left out, the forgotten man and woman. So as you can imagine, if you're being branded as a guy who wants to get rid of blue-collar jobs, that may not be someone you that might get over the finish line for labor secretary. So there's that too. So, you know, there are people who are not going to make it through the process. Now, obviously, Matt Gaetz is top of mind for a lot of people. He's getting a lot of negative blowback on social media, online, people in Washington, because of the allegations that have been, you know, sent his way. And in particular, it is regarding sex trafficking allegations where he brought underage girls across state lines and may have allegedly had relations with them in a physical manner that is inappropriate. Also drugging some of these people, as well as illegal drug use on a plane one time. There are these allegations, and also there are accusations that he was showing inappropriate, sexually explicit content to his colleagues on the House floor. So there's a lot of controversy surrounding this guy. I mean, he was always stirring up trouble for Kevin McCarthy when he was the Speaker of the House. And it was all about this ethics report, because the House was reportedly on the verge of really finishing this up. And now Gaetz has said he's out immediately. He has resigned from Congress before even having a single confirmation hearing for the Attorney General spot. Now, why, you might say that is a little controversial is because usually you wait till after you've been given the job officially, like the vote has gone through and you got it. Because what if you don't? Then you lose the House seat. And for Gates, maybe he didn't put that in perspective or what the deal was. But anyways, there, as a result of Matt Gaetz leaving, the Ethics Committee is now going to, all likelihood, suspend their investigation, and that report may or may not see the light of day. So, you know, there's people speculating online and this was on purpose and it was all part of some, you know, conspiracy theory to keep all this stuff locked up about Matt Gaetz and he could go on and do something else. We don't know. There is also the loyalty factor that Gaetz has been a staunch supporter of former President Trump. He's been on a lot of high profile committees, including the Judiciary Committee in the House. So he's a guy who has been in the spotlight, who has talked a lot about the Justice Department and how he feels that's been weaponized against Republicans, especially the president-elect, and that he got in the top job, the chief law enforcement job in this country, he would act on that. And that, you know, he would try to make it a department in the vision that Trump sees. So that could be why Trump picked him. We don't know the specifics other than obviously what he says publicly. And we're going to see where this pick goes. Again, that's probably the most controversial of the list. There's also Robert F. Kennedy Jr. A lot of people aren't sure, is he really in anything? He wants to focus on health. And he has been a skeptic of vaccines in the past and has said he wants to really scale down the health workers in the federal government, especially with NIH, and also wants to, you know, mess around with the way food is regulated in this country and drugs and essentially change up that process as well as what they test for and wants to examine what's going into our bodies. So he has gotten that. That pick could also see some pushback too, considering there's a lot of Democrats who don't really, you know, they really don't see eye to eye him. As you recall, he ran against Biden. He obviously lost. Well, he really actually dropped out of the primary because he was struggling to get ballot access and then became an independent. Now, here's what we're getting in the middle of this week. Special counsel Jack Smith has asked to pause the federal government's appeal of President-elect Trump's classified documents dismissal. In a filing to the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals, Smith requests a pause until December 2nd, quote, to afford the government time to assess this unprecedented circumstance and determine the appropriate course going forward consistent with Department of Justice policy. As a result of the election held on November 5th, 2024, one of the defendants in this case, Donald J. Trump, is expected to be certified as president-elect on January 6th, 2025, and inaugurated on January 20th, 2025. According to DOJ policy, the department is barred from prosecuting a sitting president due to its position in the executive branch of government. Smith made the same request in the federal election case, which Judge Tanya Chutkan has granted. This comes as he, along with his team, are expected to resign before Trump even takes office. The special counsel's team is reportedly wrapping up its work. Now, Trump has said in the past that he would fire Jack Smith within, quote, 2 seconds, close quote, of getting into office. Joining me now to break all this down is Rutgers political science and law professor Joe Leo Carney Warden. Professor, thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me as always, Joey. I definitely appreciate it.
I want to dive into how Trump's legal challenges are affected by this election result, but I want to dive into a little more on the specific numbers here in this election because they're kind of shocking to some people, including specifically in the Garden State. New Jersey ended up being much closer than expected. Vice President Harris only carried the state by single digits. The Senate race was a similar result. You've said in the past that Democrats should not take any statewide race for granted in New Jersey. Is this an outcome you expected?
I most certainly did. I most certainly did. I have been saying for years that, you know, half jokingly, but certainly pointing to the influence of the southern portion of New Jersey, that the South would rise again. And South Jersey certainly gave us a taste of exactly how conservative how much red is being blended in with that blue to make what was in essence a very purple state. And the same was true in places like Monmouth County and others, Sussex County, so forth and so on, where you saw large, unabashed Republican numbers. And what I was also seeing, particularly in the south of Jersey, was not what we have come to expect in terms of more Tory Republicans, as I've called them, referencing the conservatives in England and how they would be more moderates here. But really what we're seeing in South Jersey, in Camden County, Burlington County, Cumberland County, Salem County, Gloucester County, are actually fire-breathing old-school conservatives, which is jarring for the majority of New Jerseyans, but as I have been saying for years, shouldn't be shocking to anyone. This is the new reality of New Jersey, and Democrats in our state can no longer afford to be complacent. They are going to have to contend in New Jersey in a way that they previously did not in the past. And the key to New Jersey for Republicans is going to be really turning out that vote in South Jersey, really whipping up the vote, because the moderate to conservative voters are there for just that.
You mentioned South Jersey, but I want to take us a little bit up north because there were some interesting numbers up there. Trump managed to flip Passaic County, which hasn't gone for a Republican in a very, very long time on the presidential front. And
that's
also
correct.
A reason for that some people are pointing to are Hispanic voters. Because if you look at these deep blue cities across the state that have large Hispanic populations, a lot of them only went for Harris by maybe 10, 15 points, depending on where you're going. I'm talking about New Brunswick, Perth Amboy, Elizabeth, just to name a few. Trump even flipped a couple of Hispanic majority, plurality towns across the state. Given that, how much is that demographic going to play in New Jersey politics going forward? And could it shake things up for both the Democrats and state politics at large?
Absolutely. One of the key words that you heard thrown about this election cycle, but it's certainly been a staple concept in political science for years, is this whole idea of depolarization. We tend to think of ethnic groups as a voting block, that they all vote the same way. And what we learned in this particular election is that the term Latino, unfortunately, doesn't give us the best understanding of the specific granular politics that were at play. What we do know in general, the macro view of things, is that whether you were Black, white, Latino, Asian, whatever, the economy was a number one issue for you. What we also saw with the Latino community was a rejection, it seemed, of what they considered to be a more radical set of politics. They didn't care for, we saw in a lot of exit polling, Latinos who were responding to issues like trans women in sports. But interestingly, the number of Latinos who were taking what appeared to be rather hardline stances on issues like immigration, which everyone presumed you would see every Latino claiming, oh, we support a more liberal, progressive, a more quote-unquote compassionate immigration policy. And yet, the exit polling tends to suggest that it depended on the specific sub-ethnic Latino group, and it was not certainly a community-wide belief. And I believe that the key for Democrats is recognizing what we have been saying for years, or what's been known for years, that the Latino community, much like the African-American community, tends to be, on the whole, a much more socially conservative community, by and large. But Republicans can also lean into that, as well as recognizing that the unifying message, regardless of race and ethnicity, appears to be economics. And particularly in New Jersey, again, Democrats are going to have to create and tailor a message that speaks specifically to each of these sub-ethnic Latino groups, instead of believing that you are going to be able to speak to each of those groups with one message. And immigration, apparently, is not that single unifying message.
I want to talk about another demographic that people are bringing up as the conversation of New Jersey comes to the forefront within the national dialogue, and that is Orthodox Jews, because they were a factor and a significant part of the population in these counties that people are looking at. If you look at Ocean County in Lakewood, then in Passaic County, there is an Orthodox Jewish population up there. How impactful will this demographic be in elections to come in the state?
One of the more unfortunate aspects to the pogrom, if you will, of October 7th was that it exposed what I consider to be a rather deep vein of anti-Jewish sentiment within the Democratic Party, and a party that has traditionally been the home of both Orthodox as well as Reform Jews, now became rather inhospitable to that same group. You had individuals who were essentially demanding that these same Jews recognize the humanity of Palestine or Palestinians, which is the right thing to do. That's a right call. But at the same time, casting them as being a part of an alleged colonial regime bent on undermining Palestinian lives, undermining a Palestinian way of life. And for a lot of Jews, that was a bridge too far. It was an absolute bridge too far. And when you had, people don't want to admit this aloud, but I think for a number of Jews, the writing was already pretty clearly on the wall. But in the choice for vice president, the choice to go with Tim Walz instead of what appeared to be obvious to everyone else, Josh Shapiro, or the obvious choice in Josh Shapiro, signaled to a number of Jews exactly what was at stake for them, that they were going to essentially have to carry a blood libel if they remained in the Democratic Party. And that was, again, too much. And so they made the decision to fundamentally switch course, and it did. It had very rich dividends for Republicans this time around, and it should certainly give every Democrat pause.
Let's talk about the Democratic Party broadly here. Democrats are in disarray over the results of the presidential race, as well as Republicans gaining control of the Senate. For people who may not know, you were formerly a Democrat. You were in that party at one point. You're no longer associated with that party. Your former party is currently trying to figure out who its next leader is going to be, as well as what the path is going forward in terms of messaging. You said not too long ago that Democrats need to tailor their message when it comes to Hispanic voters, specifically for certain subgroups. Where do you see the party going from here?
Unfortunately, I can't make that prediction until we see who wins the current debate. Because right now we have disparate voices that there are these absurd factors that went into why they lost, i.e. the economy and disinformation or misinformation and any number of things other than reckoning with the current state of the party and the message, the platform. They refuse to do the introspective work that's necessary. So then you have those who are honestly taking that responsibility seriously, and they want to have that conversation. They are saying, no, what we have been supporting in the past is lunacy, and we need to change course. And there is merit to their particular claims. I can't predict where the party will go next, Joey, until we have a clear understanding of who wins that debate. If and when we have that winner, then it should be pretty obvious. But until then, it looks like there are some strong voices on either side, and neither appears to be ceding ground to the other. And so I am hoping that the Democratic Party returns to the party that I loved, participated actively in, and want to see again, and that was the party of Clinton. That was the party of, dare I say, Kennedy. But that's the Democratic Party I'd like to see return, but unfortunately, the very hard conversations we're having right now don't appear to show us doing just that.
I know you say that it's hard to predict where this is going to go, but there's a few directions where they could go, especially when it comes to presidential candidates for 2028. You have a possible Gavin Newsom wing of it where some might say, okay, maybe we need to stop going for the diversity thing. Just pick this clean-cut looking guy from California, run him. He's an establishment figure, and go from there. You also got the Josh Shapiro wing of the party that's like, hey, you know, he was pretty good. Maybe we should have picked him as vice president. Maybe we should pick him again, especially as he appeals to people in a swing state who need to win, as well as to voters that were formerly part of the Democratic coalition who may not necessarily be with us now. And then finally, you have Maryland Governor Wes Moore, who is an African-American male and maybe could represent a Obama-like coalition. Are those the options in your mind? Do you see that, or do you think there's other wings and possible options for the Democratic Party moving into the next 4 years?
Oh, well, certainly. I mean, those obviously do represent viable options. I'm not necessarily pleased with them as they are presented, for the exception of Josh Shapiro, who is popular in Pennsylvania, not simply because he's Josh Shapiro, but because he's proven to be a very capable executive. Contrast that with Gavin Newsom, who I quite frankly think has done more harm to California than not by choosing not to stand up and against some of the more radical ideas and elements in his state. There is obviously a lane for Wes Moore. I don't know if he's the person that should be driving in it, but there's definitely a lane there. But I will say that with her increased popularity and cachet, there is a burgeoning move toward Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez to represent the progressives. I do not frankly believe that the energy is there for a run like that from Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez or any progressive not named Bernie Sanders, who clearly it can't be by virtue of his age alone the future of the party. So there is certainly that. There is talk of that as a potential progressive lane, but I'll be very honest with you, Joey, the prospects that are being rolled out, whether it's Matt Bevin or Bashir or Whitmer or Pritzker, these particular names that are being bandied about right now don't inspire much in the way of confidence that the Democrats are going to get it together and come up with a singular rallying or unifying message that will compel the public to them. But we'll see.
Very quickly here before we move on, with Josh Shapiro, the obvious elephant in the room with him not being picked as vice president was accusations of anti-Semitism. Some people saying because he was a Jew that they thought maybe he would risk Michigan or any other possible Democratic coalitions among Arab Americans who may be more sympathetic to the Palestinian cause and not so thrilled with Shapiro's past pro-Israel stances. Can a Jew be elected as a Democrat in today's modern era?
Well, the closest that we had to answering that question was in the late Senator Joseph Lieberman, and all of the historians tend to suggest that Joe Lieberman and specifically the Al Gore ticket suffered in part, the degree to which we don't know, but it suffered in part because of the fact that Joe Lieberman was indeed Jewish, and because of the fact that he held very pro-Israel views very much the same way as Josh Shapiro did. Joe Lieberman wondered aloud that very point. And when you have election, or you have Democratic stalwarts like the documentarian Michael Moore literally saying aloud, "Do not choose Josh Shapiro, he will lose Michigan for us," because of, and it's being couched as his pro Israel positions and his past statements about Palestinians, but everyone knew the truth. You could have taken the most pro-Palestinian Jewish candidate, and they likely would have been targeted as unelectable. I don't believe in this current climate, Joey. I hate to say this, and it actually pains me to say this. This is the first time I've said it out loud publicly. I don't believe it's possible for you to be Jewish and to win the presidency, or at least the presidential nomination from the Democratic Party. So I hate to say that, but I just don't. I'm sorry. I just don't believe that to be the case.
Let's move on to the legal challenges for Trump. Obviously, he still has to deal with these potential court battles despite being the president-elect. The judge in his New York criminal trial, Juan Merchan, has delayed his ruling on how the Supreme Court presidential immunity decision affects his case until this coming Tuesday. How do you think he will rule on that?
I believe that Judge Merchan should, of course, obviously dismiss the case. The case was, by every objective measure, and it's been across the political spectrum, those lawyers who are in the know truly do believe that the case was politically motivated. And in addition to being politically motivated, they also believe that the case was essentially trash. No one believed that this was a case that should have ever been brought. That said, you are going to have a very difficult time convincing. You're going to have a very difficult time convincing individuals of that particular fact. You are going to have a number of people who are going to say no one is above the law, and they believe that this case should be, that he should be sentenced. The legalities of sentencing and imprisoning a duly elected president of the United States of America is insane. To put it in the vernacular, it's crazy. I believe that Judge Merchan will, I believe honestly, because I am one of those individuals who does believe that there was some, I don't believe it was completely, but I do believe there was some coordination, if you will, between the Justice Department and the state prosecutors and attorney generals in prepping these cases and making them. I do believe that now that you have seen the special counsel, Jack Smith, drop these cases, I do believe that the state will, I believe the state will give a rather mealy-mouthed, if you will, a rather tepid nod to its, you know, a rather tepid nod to him not being above the law, but the technical aspects of things suggest, hey, let's go ahead and dismiss. And I do believe the judge would be right to do so. And to be quite frank, I don't believe that this case was going to survive on appeal. I truly believe that the overwhelming majority, you know, I truly believe that, like the overwhelming majority of legal scholars who looked at this case, and I looked at it in myriad ways and from myriad angles, just don't believe it will survive. Just don't believe it would have survived appeal. So that even if he were sentenced, an appeal, an immediate appeal would go up to the New York Court of Appeal. And I, again, believe it would be immediately extinguished at that point.
So just to be clear here, you believe that this case will be dismissed on the grounds of the Supreme Court presidential immunity decision? Because also there's that other factor, too. If, let's say, Mershon threw out that part and said, oh, you know, I think this has nothing to do with this at all, we can continue on. He still has to decide whether the sentencing hearing that's scheduled on the 26th can move forward, given that Trump will be returning to the White House in January. You think it's just going to stop merely at the presidential immunity decision? You don't think it's going to have to deal anything with the fact that former President Trump will be returning to the White House on January 20th?
I think that Judge Mershon may very well couch it in those terms in order to, you know, he may very well, again, quote the mantra or chant the mantra, nobody's above the law, nobody's above the law. That's fine. But everybody understands that this is not, that if you do dismiss, you're not dismissing because you truly and honestly believe that presidential immunity applies. I'm one of those individuals who believes that if the president of that if President-elect Trump had not won the election, Judge Mershon was not going to dismiss on the, he was not going to dismiss on the immunity issue. I don't believe that. I believe that these stall tactics were simply, well, I shouldn't say stall tactics because that's maybe not fair, but I don't believe that these delays were because they were really trying to figure out the scope of the immunity cases several months after the court has already ruled. It's clear that what is going on is they were looking to see the outcome of the election and asking the question of whether we want to be the first state and whether Judge Mershon wanted to be the first judge in history to imprison a duly elected president of the United States. Even saying that aloud seems absolutely, positively absurd. And I can't, and no one believes that that isn't a part of his consideration here. No one doesn't. And so I do believe it may be couched in terms of an immunity, the immunity decision, but I don't believe that anybody worth their salt can honestly say that that's the motivation here. The motivation is the reality that you are seriously contemplating imprisoning a duly elected president of the United States of America.
You say that there, you believe there was some coordination between these states and the Justice Department for these cases. Yes. As of right now, we haven't seen that hard evidence. We've seen some congressional documents put out by Republican congressional committees investigating the Justice Department saying, well, this person was there at this time, and that there was this Justice Department log or the Secret Service log or something to do with the White House. There was some kind of like vague connection, but we haven't seen that hard evidence yet. What evidence can you point to suggest that there is direct coordination between the Biden Justice Department and D.A. Bragg and Fannie Willis and all these people that suggests what conservatives would say is to get Trump.
Yes, the reason why I hesitate to use the term collusion, which is what you hear most often from, it's what you hear most often from the right, that there was collusion of some sort. That's not what I'm referring to. I'm referring to coordination in terms of logistics. The very fact that you have people who, witnesses that are in common in a number of these cases, evidence that the feds might have or that the state might have. And so the lawyers are actually speaking in the same way that if you had a case in which the state was bringing a particular indictment at the same time the federal government is, there's going to be conversations between the U.S. Attorney's office and that prosecutor's office. That's what I'm alleging. I don't mean to suggest, although unfortunately there might have been, or not unfortunately, but that there definitely was some sort of coordination in order to make sure that they weren't stepping on each other's toes, proverbial toes, and by that I mean overstepping jurisdictional issues, that they were, using evidence prudently in a way that didn't affect each other's cases, things of that nature. So the better word would be coordination rather than collusion or conspiracy.
I want to move on to the more federal aspect of this. Judge Tanya Chutkan has paused the proceedings for Trump's federal election case at the request of special counsel Jack Smith. Smith says that this will give him and the government time to weigh how to move forward with the case. He says there'll be an answer by December 2nd. This also comes as the Justice Department previously was trying to challenge the decision by a Florida federal judge to dismiss the classified documents case based on a technicality. How do you see both of these cases playing out in the long run? Is the Justice Department going to, dismiss it? Are they going to drop the cases? Is Jack Smith going to resign? What's going to happen here between now and December?
Well, you only need look to some of the statements made by Judge Chutkan. Judge Chutkan said, no matter what decision she makes in this case, it's going to be appealed. And we already saw that with the case out of Florida with Judge Eileen Cannon. It was going to be appealed. The reason why that particular step proves fatal to the federal government's cases is that everyone in their right mind knows that once President Trump becomes president, he is going to nominate an attorney general who will, in all likelihood, to shut down the case, to fire Jack Smith, and everyone move on with their lives, which will then cause whichever court is entertaining the appeal at that time to now argue that all of these issues are moot as the Justice Department has moved to actually settle the claims or has moved to dismiss the claims. We know that there is not going to be a trial on the merits in Florida or in D.C. between now and then. So to me, it seems utterly ridiculous to continue to prolong the inevitable, but I understand. There has to be a respect for the process. And so we want to respect how things are actually handled. And so for the sake of process, this is going to be drawn out.
Well, we'll have to see where this case goes moving forward, as well as all his other legal challenges. Rutgers political science and law professor Joe Leo Carney Warren, thank you so much for joining me. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Joey. I always appreciate it.
We'll be back next week with more In the Middle right here on Fox Sports, New Jersey.